Welcome to the HR Business Blueprint Podcast. I'm Nikki Masterman, founder and managing director of Inspired HR. Today, I am joined by the wonderful Alfie Joey. Now, I originally met Alfie Joey at local events, awards, dinners. He always acts as compere. That's how I originally met him. Wonderful, wonderful speaker. But over the time I've got to know him, I've found out he's a multi-talented artist. And let's just say I am in podcast and radio royalty today. Yeah. As he, for anyone who knows Alfie, he used to be a writer, a radio presenter, he's an actor, he is a singer, he's an impressionist, he is a comedian, and he used to be a monk, and we will hear all about that story. So, Alfie, thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be here, Nikki. Very excited. I'm the one who should be excited.
Oh, not at all. I am in royalty today.
Not a bit of it.
I'm on my journey of podcasting at the moment. I'm sure that I know there's a lot I can still learn from you. And I do. I watch you quite avidly. Alfie, I would love you to share your story with our listeners about your journey, because I remember the first time I heard it, I was just in absolute awe. It is the most wonderful story, and I want you to share it with our listeners.
Well, it's funny. It doesn't seem impressive to me, because it's just what I did. And in fact, it's almost like looking back on someone else's life, because it's so different to what I do now. But I was born in a pit village about 7 miles east of Durham City. And my dad was a coal miner, and he worked down the pit. And I was, you know, going to go down the pit. That was what you did. But from a very young age, I wanted to be a priest. And I've no idea why. My dad was Catholic, didn't go to church. My mum wasn't Catholic. I used to go to church with an old auntie. I was very boringly nice when I was little. So irritating. I hated the former me. And so I would do things that were nice, and when I did a paper round, I'd knock on people's doors and say, do you want shopping and stuff like that? And so I think they didn't have social workers, or I wasn't aware of what social workers or anything were back then. So I'm guessing maybe it came from there. Maybe I saw the priest, who was the bloke who went round and was nice to people and talked. It's a bit showbiz being a priest as well, isn't it? You get the gear on, you have a captive audience. It's almost like theatre in church. And so when you're little and you draw something in the book and your teacher says, draw something, and you draw a nurse or a cowboy, I want to be an astronaut, I drew a priest. And it became not unusual for people to presume that that's what I would do. My teachers just accepted it. And then it became normal for my friends to say, well, that's what you're going to do. And eventually, I had a few years at Peatley Comprehensive School, and but the parish priest and my headmaster said, are you sure this is what you want? So they came and spoke to me mum and dad. It was a bit like Billy Elliot, the miners' strike and all that sort of stuff. Except instead of being a ballet dancer, I went away to this mini Hogwarts to train to be a priest. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was I cannot think of any other sphere of life where I would have collected so many experiences, because eventually when I went to senior seminary, you do placements and you become a school chaplain, a hospice chaplain, a prison chaplain. I spent 2 years in Durham and Franklin prisons. And yeah, it was a very, very privileged position. And eventually when I ended up on the radio, I remember one hard-bitten cynical journalist saying, what do you know about journalism, when I got the breakfast show? First of all, I should have said, what do you know about show business? But I didn't. But also, I think it almost qualified me, because I wasn't a trained journalist. But having those incredible experiences of working in all of those places with a role of kind of authority, I had a real insight into what it was like to be in a hospital, to be in a prison, which is really useful when you've got a radio show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what about the rest of your career journey? Tell us about the rest of your career journey.
So, fast forward, I spent 15 years in religious life. And then when I got to the age of around 30, early 30s, I was still with the religious order. And I was in London. And I don't know if you know this story, but I was doing a degree to teach in one of our schools because our religious order worked in tough areas where there's lots of poverty, and those are the only areas we worked in, really. And I found drama was the best way to communicate. It was just a brilliant way to get children just to escape and be someone else and pretend and create something. And it was just great. That and football were the two. I didn't do anything religious. I used to just do sort of sport or drama. It was a great way of connecting with young people as a school chaplain. So the order sent me to London. I did a drama degree. And at first I thought, I'm not going to tell the students I'm in a religious order. They're going to think I'm a crackpot and they're not going to speak to me. They're not going to swear. So I hid it. I didn't tell them. But I became really good friends with them. Mm-hmm. And you bond really quickly when you're studying and we're doing a drama degree, so you're acting in things. And after a while, it became more and more difficult. I was living a double life, basically. So I can remember there was a class where they were saying, why aren't you coming out of the pub? Why aren't you staying out? We're all going to Thingry's house. And I'm thinking, I've got to get back to the monastery. but I didn't tell them that. So I always had to go back and get the last tube. Oh, I live in Battersea. And then they go, well, we'll all come to yours. And we're not tonight. It's difficult where I live. And so I was living a lie. So there was a drama class, where the lecturer said, right, one of those sessions where we're all going to try and say something about ourselves that nobody else knows. So everybody went round and said, you know, I once got a red belt in karate or whatever. And it got to me and I said, I'm a monk. And they all went, whoa. And some people were crying, they were hugging me. But it all made sense to them then. Uh-huh. And they went, we knew there was something, we couldn't work it out. But they didn't stop swearing. They treated me like one of them and I was their mate. They respected it and they were brilliant. And then after that, I did a module in stand-up comedy as part of the degree. Middlesex University was the first university to do stand-up as a module. Yeah. And that changed my life. That was almost like an epiphany. And I just thought, this is what I've always wanted to do. I'd always loved getting up and doing a turn. As a kid, I'd enter talent shows and I'd sing a song in front of people or do a turn, do impressions. I always did impressions when I was small. So suddenly, I had a comedy course that was going to result in me doing stand-up live, and it was the best feeling. It was almost like an ecstasy. And so that was it. I went back and I told one of the priests and said, I love this comedy. And he said, you've made your mind up, haven't you? And I said, I think I have. And then I went through the process. You have to write to the Vatican and you get a letter back in Latin, and then you leave sort of officially. And it was really good to leave on good terms because they'd been so good with me and they mm-hmm. were brilliant, and I still keep in touch, and they've been to see the odd show and stuff like that, and they were so supportive when I left. Maybe they wanted rid of me. But it was so strange leaving. That was hard because I'd never been really in the outside world, and it was noisy. And I was living in halls of residence, and it was just after the tranquility and the rhythm and routine of getting up really early and you do morning prayer, mass, breakfast with the brothers, mm-hmm. and then you go off and do your job and you come back and you have a very, very specific lifestyle. I imagine it's similar to leaving the army or leaving prison or an institution that's very fixed, and then you don't know what to do. And I was at a bit of a loss when I first left, but then it settled down with the comedy.
And then you're the former presenter of the BBC Newcastle Breakfast Show. Tell us about that.
Well, again, happy accidents just kept happening to me because I just kept making myself available. I would just turn up and do things when people asked. So as a comedian, my first radio appearance, probably as a comedian, was I did a show at the Edinburgh Festival. And you got to do something to stand out there to get an audience because there's so many shows. And I did it in the early 2000s. And the average audience then was 7. So I thought, what can I do? And I was driving some comedians back from a gig. And one of them said, you're funnier in the car than you are on stage. You should do a show in your car. So I mentioned it to my agent and he went, it'll work. So I had to register the car as a theatre. It was called Alfie Joy's Mini Cabaret.
Right.
And I wasn't allowed to drive and do the show at the same time. So we had a parking permit near one of the big venues. To qualify as a venue, the fire brigade had to come out and check my car. And they didn't. They were as confused as I was. They're there kicking the tyres going, we don't really know what to say.
And just, did you meet the fire regulations?
Yes. The exits were there and there. And you had to do all that because it was a proper venue.
There's the handle to get out the car.
Yeah, it had its own number. And during one show, it was weird because some shows I'd have two people reviewing it with the pens out and two other people. So 50% of the audience were reviewers. And they were the weirdest. I can remember one show, three Swedish sailors in the back seats and a schoolgirl in the front. And that I had to do an hour of comedy in the car.
Okay.
And I had a fixed show. I'd written a show, so It worked in the car. But it was really point blank. They were right up as close as you could get an audience to be. So I did this show, and it got a bit of recognition. It was a question on The Weakest Link, and it was on Sky News, covered at Daily Mirror. And they love a novelty show at the Edinburgh Festival. So that kind of really worked. And BBC Scotland did a feature on me and offered me a regular feature on BBC Scotland. So I used to do a feature every week, I think it was, called What's It All About, Alfie? And they'd play the theme and they would say something topical that was in the news, and I'd have to do a few minutes on it, a monologue about ID cards or whatever was in the news at the time. And that went on for years. And from that, other people would say, will you come on our radio station and review some papers? Will you do a feature on our radio station? Will you cover on BBC Sheffield? And that was snowballing quite a bit. And at the time, I was in a sitcom and I was doing lots of TV warm-up work for TV shows like University Challenge, that kind of thing. And then I got a call from the boss of BBC Newcastle saying, would you consider doing an afternoon show? And I thought, oof, that will uproot everything, because I was living in Manchester at the time, And I was getting all these other work opportunities, and that is a real sliding doors moment, because I have no idea what would have happened if I'd stayed there, because I was in Coronation Street and probably done lots more acting work, I guess. But I'm glad I made the move I did, because I never thought I'd move back to the Northeast, and it was the best thing I did, and it was just great to be back, and it was the best job I've ever had, probably. I loved it, and I wasn't a journalist, so I thought I'd just keep doing the afternoon show, which was sort of light entertainment, celebrity interviews, play songs, and then within a short space of time, I was put on The Breakfast Show with Charlie Charlton. We were teamed as a double act, and I learned all I know about journalism from Charlie. She's a very dedicated interviewer, and I just watched her like a hawk and started to do similar things, and we had a good blend and loved it.
And I know Charlie, and actually until you've just talked, I never, because I moved away from the Northeast at 17 and I was away for a lot of years. I never actually heard you and Charlie on The Breakfast Show, but I didn't actually realise until now that was as who you did the show with, because I love Charlie. She's my other favourite local compere. Beautiful lady, beautiful person. And then, I mean, that must have just been an experience, just doing that breakfast show. And I'm going to touch on that again in a moment. But where you are now, we're going to be talking about how you do panto impressions. Mm. Give us a couple of your favourite impressions, Alfie.
I love doing world leaders, I suppose, in the news all the time right now. Mm-hmm. I love doing people that I've not heard anyone else do. And so I used to, as a kid, I used to do lots of American presidents.
Uh-huh.
So Bill Clinton, I want you to listen to me. I want to say this again. I did not have relations with that woman. So I'll do anyone who's on telly, and you just quote their lines. George Bush, you know, at the Sorrow Coalition Force defending national security. And Obama was the one I was happiest with, because no one else did him. Uh-huh. And then I realised why, because he doesn't actually say much in his speeches. It's all about the pauses. Mm-hmm. And that gives him that statesman-like aura and that coolness. So he'll say, "We're big pause. Need another big pause. Change." Everybody cheers. And then if I was in a comedy club, I would do them doing it in a different situation. So I do, in a comedy club, I do Barack Obama reading his kid a story at bedtime, but it wouldn't have the same sort of aura or excitement. She sells on the seashore. Michelle, take over, I'm aboard. And then you'd have the Donald. I can't imagine him reading anybody a story, apart from himself, maybe in the mirror. But Humpty Dumpty had a great wall, not as good as my wall, built around Mexico. So there you go. There's a few impressions.
And I can imagine Donald Trump has certainly given you some...
Well...
Some kind of stuff to do, comedy at the moment.
Well, but I don't find it funny. It's just frightening now.
It is frightening.
It's just become fascinating. I'm fascinated by all communicators, good and bad. And Boris Johnson is someone I use sometimes when I do coaching, because he was always held up as a really good communicator. He could connect with the public and, you know, let's get Brexit done, blah, blah. And he's a showman. But sometimes it doesn't mean you're a great communicator. It sometimes can mean your message is all over the place. There was a great, it's on YouTube, moment when Boris Johnson came to the Northeast. I think it was the Port of Tyne. And he did a speech that wasn't prepared at all. And he got lost. He lost his place several times. He started talking about Peppa Pig. And it was a disaster. And at the end, the ITV news guy said to him, "Frankly, Prime Minister, is everything all right?" And he went, "Well, I thought it went over rather well." And it was clearly a disaster. So sometimes these people say, well, he was a good communicator. Well, Hitler was a good communicator, if you put it in those terms. But does it mean the message is decent?
Yes.
And sometimes it isn't.
No, absolutely. And of course, that then leads on to, you are a public speaking coach and known as the Speak Easy Guy. So what is that? Tell us about that.
Well, it was an idea someone else had. When I left the BBC, I moved into pantomime. that was the job that got me out of the BBC. Oh, yes, it was.
And No, it wasn't.
Great fun doing that. Absolutely brilliant. But I needed something else as well for a business model to work, to feed the family, to pay the bills. So it was someone else whose podcast I'd been on who suggested that I do it. And so I looked into it and I thought, I didn't believe at first that I'd have enough clout to teach people about communication. But they replied back to me what I'd said on their podcast. And they said, "You've been a comedian for 25 years plus. You've been on radio for 15 years on the BBC. You were given sermons in cathedrals. You know a lot more about communication techniques in different ways. Most people who do this are just come at it from one angle, whether it's podcasting or radio, but you've got this sort of net that goes further. So why not just dip into that?" And I know you've said it on the first episode of your very good podcast.
Oh, thank you.
That qualifications are not always required. And I don't have any journalistic qualifications or communication qualifications, but I'm probably much more qualified than a lot of people who've got some pieces of paper saying that they can coach this stuff. And I do think I was a student of it. Even before all of this, as a kid, I was obsessed with chat show hosts, with communicators, with presidents. And as a young impressionist, I was studying people's communication techniques without even knowing it. So I was almost an accidental student of it. I've been obsessed with it all my life. I find it absolutely fascinating. I still do. I'll watch those awful shopping channels where someone who has no interest in Egyptian cotton towels will spend 25 minutes telling you how good they are on Bid Up TV or Price Drop TV. I'll just watch them to see how they can keep the energy up and do the sell and tell you stories about this stuff. And it's all utter rubbish. But from a communication standpoint, it's a fascinating thing to watch. TV evangelists. I don't believe in this stuff anymore, despite having done all that for a long time. Mm-hmm. I will watch them on these channels for 15, 20 minutes just to see what they're doing, just to listen to the stories they tell, to watch the stagecraft. And I think it never stops. It should never stop. You should always try and improve and try and better yourself as a communicator, certainly if you're a coach, and just look at all techniques, look at all examples that are out there. And now there's YouTube, there's streaming stuff happening all the time.
Mm-hmm. And actually crafting and learning from what you do is clearly very important. And, you know, we've spoken about this before, where the prime conversation we're having today is because of the importance of communicating clearly. So, you know, in my field, how do we communicate what we do clearly? How do we get ourselves out there? How do we get known as consultants? How do we raise our profile? How do people learn we even exist? Because so many companies still don't know HR consultants and service industry that I'm in even exist. But you talk about, you know, watching and observing and learning. And I'm like you. I'm very good at what I do. My clients will tell you that. But like you, it is because I practice, I learn. I've never gone the formal educational route. And like you, I can still, you know, sometimes beat hands down an individual that may have gone that route. And that doesn't take away the value of what they do. But I craft and I learn, and I learn what's needed. And it is. And, you know, we were talking about podcasts and your career on radio. And I go back and listen to some of my earlier podcasts, and we're our biggest critic. And I listen to my tone of voice in them. I listen to where I might pause or interrupt. I think about how natural I am in it, or does it feel a little bit too scripted for me? And, you know, this is, I've learned just in the short podcasts that I've been doing, it's so important to listen to myself and learn from that. And I believe you did the same when it came to your history.
Absolutely. And don't stop doing that either, because we're in the fantastic Morgia Studios and, you know, it's perfect. Mm-hmm. But you can invest all you want in equipment, but if you haven't invested in how to present, it's all pointless. And your constant search for improvement will make your podcast better and better. And you turned up to a session I did at Media Born, where I was telling people tips, tools and tactics how to improve your communication. You're interested in learning. You're interested in development. You have to be to get better. And the podcasts who, and some of which I have to say I've coached, have not moved on because they sound exactly the same on episode 50 as they do in episode 1. Mm-hmm. And that is not what it should be like. When I started on the radio, I was dreadful. And I've told this story many times. A guy texted in the first week I was on the afternoon show and said, "Mate, you're rubbish. I'll give you 6 weeks." And the same person texted the week I left and said, and it's funny, you get loads of really nice messages and you never remember them, but you always remember the bad ones. Mm-hmm. And on the last week, the same person, nearly 15 years later, sent a message in and said, "I messaged you in the first week and I said something horrible. I said you wouldn't last 6 weeks." Of course I remembered them. And I want to say sorry because I'm a big fan. I'm going to really miss you. And I read it out on air. And the breakfast team go, "What are you reading that for? It's your last week. You should be..." I said, "No, I think it's really important that people know that you don't start off as the finished article. You've got to be lousy before you can get good."
Yeah.
You know, no one starts... Picasso's pictures would have been not out of place on a fridge door when he's... Look at all Spider-Man artists. You look at all of those brilliant artists. They all drew stick figures when they first drew. Mm-hmm. It's a skill. And I'm absolutely adamant that speaking and broadcasting is a skill and not a talent. And I can go back to any of my speaking disciplines, whether it's stand-up comedy, whether it's giving a sermon, whether it's giving a keynote speech, and I was dreadful when I started. And I mean dreadful. But I loved it and I wanted it to be good and I worked at it. Mm-hmm. And I think with this kind of industry and this kind of performance, I think it's crucial you listen back. You you have to almost not like yourself at the beginning and say, right, well, I'm going to change that. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do that again. And when we did, as a team, Charlie Charlton and myself did the breakfast show, our boss, the first manager, was just a great, great radio man. He really knew how to put people together and get the best out of them. And he was very quiet. He didn't say much. But he used that sort of Socratic method where he would get you to say what you'd done wrong rather than he wouldn't point it out. Mm-hmm. He would just say, what do you think's happening there in this bit here when we listen back? Mm-hmm. And we would just say, well, I've just asked too many questions. And I asked elongated questions and I could ask shorter questions, so we won't do that tomorrow. And you just pick on just very, very forensically. We'd go through and we'd only listen to, say, 5 minutes of our output. We'd usually listen around the 10 past eight mark when most people are going to school or to work. And we'd listen to the same 5 minutes of one of our competitors. And I would do exactly the same with your podcast. If you do a podcast, I would find one of your competitors or one of your heroes who you mm-hmm. really like and listen to 5 minutes of them and 5 minutes of you. Mark yourself, mm-hmm. mark them and see what the scores are and try mm-hmm. and catch them up. And that's what we did. So we would listen to 5 minutes of us. Have we mentioned who we are? Have we mentioned something entertaining? Have we mentioned something informing? Have we told people the time? Have we ticked lots of boxes? Mm-hmm. And then we'd listen to Chris Evans or Metro Radio or someone else and how they scored against us. Mm-hmm. And some days we'd lose and some days we'd be catching them up.
Yeah.
And eventually this process, most people, by the way, at the radio station detested doing this and would get out of it and not want to do it. And me and Charlie were a bit sadomasochistic and we would go, nope, we'll do it. And the boss was very thorough with us because the breakfast show was the big one.
Yeah.
And we did it every Wednesday. And when we won Station of the Year and we won different awards, and we became, I think, the most listened to BBC local station outside London.
Yeah.
Not because of us, because of the Snoop, because of that routine of listening back and sandpapering the rough bits every week. And it was that consistency, that turning up and just being self-critical, mm-hmm. not navel gazing, like detrimental introspection, but right, come on, let's be honest with what we're doing here. That bit's too long. Let's not do that long bit anymore. Let's shorten that and keep it entertaining, keep it sharp. And it was that made us better.
So really what you're saying is that when it comes to getting ourselves out there, and I mean, I do public speaking, I get up on stage, I have obviously got the podcast, I am quite happy to go speak at events, whether that's school, and I actually find school more nervous than standing on a stage with 5,000 people in front of me, you know, and I do that. I mean, I'm nowhere near on your level. I love what I do. I talk with passion. It's always about a subject I'm authentic about, whether that's neurodiversity or HR or people. But like you, I'm always learning. If I'm doing coaching, I'll read coaching books. If I'm doing neurodiversity, I'll read a book on neurodiversity, because the world is ever evolving and learning. So what you're saying is really is we have to learn from our mistakes. Mm. We have to make the mistakes to learn from them. But we have to have the courage to get out there and do it as well. And in my sector and in my field, when you're building a business, you've got to have the courage to do that, whether that's a 60 seconds at your local BNI meeting.
Yeah.
Or it's up on stage talking about a subject you're passionate about, or it's doing a webinar with my favourite Cat Moody and Richard Reed solicitors. And people think it's easy. It's not. Yeah. I talk about faking it until you're making it. And people go, oh, you're so confident on stage. You have no idea about the nerves. I'm very good at hiding it. Don't believe everything you see.
Snap. Yeah. I was at a networking meeting this morning, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, my local pub, perfect. And the bar's not open. It's just a breakfast. And it was interesting this morning because I was doing a session on communication for them. So we did our usual bit where we all pitch, and I listened carefully. And I thought, who can I use as an example? And it was the most unlikely guy. And he just told a tiny story. And it was the only person for me that landed going around the table. And I was quite honest with them. And I said, Craig, are you comfortable talking? He said, not really. I said, you landed your message today. She told a lovely little story about being on a Zoom meeting with someone and how it made a difference. Whereas everyone else, I said, me included, just said what I did and what I want. And I said, and that's not good enough. I said, mm-hmm. It's a land grab now for attention. And we're not very good, certainly in this country, at showing our medals. I talk about this a lot when I do workshops and I do keynotes. But you have to get better at talking about what you do with pride. And the best business people that I've interviewed are the passionate ones. And you can't shut them up. They're mm-hmm. like a child. Sir John Timpson talking about Timpsons, mm-hmm. talking about key cutting and fixing broken shoes. Angus Thirlwall from Hotel Chocolat talking about chocolate and grating the chocolate on his poached eggs. Mm-hmm. They're telling stories. And it's stories that will stick, stories that connect your mm-hmm. message to your business. And I think if you get better at doing that, you've got more of a chance. But the opportunity now in business, we've had the Zoom boom, we've had the Reels revolution. There's free opportunity, and charities do my fruit in. Because I love charities and I do a lot of work with charities and I host more charity balls than anyone else in the Northeast. But they frustrate the hell out of me because they're so modest. Mm-hmm. And they look inwards and they know everything about the charity and they know how it works and they know why it's brilliant. They know who it serves, but they don't get that message out there. Mm-hmm. If I ask them, right, do a LinkedIn post about that. Right, do a reel. Well, I'm not really good at that. I'm not very good at that. Well, bloody start. Mm-hmm. Start now because it's your duty. And if I'm amazed that some charities, big charities, come to me for help. I think if anyone comes to me for help, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. I'm just a bloke with a phone. But they will come up to me and go, you've got very good socials. And I go, mm-hmm. I haven't got a choice. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a social media manager. I haven't got a manager. I haven't got an agent. I'm just me with a phone. You're a big charity with a big turnover. You're a business. Mm-hmm. I think it's your responsibility to get better at that. And imagine if you could take your public, listen to me getting all excited now. Imagine if you could take your public speaking skills from memorable to being unforgettable. Mm-hmm. What would that do to your charity, to your business, and to your own self-confidence? Yeah. I'll tell you the answer. It would revolutionise what you do. And I get absolutely amazed when people don't, oh, it's all right for you, it's good. And I'm absolutely clear when people say that to me, it wasn't all right for me when I started. I was dreadful. You have to start somewhere. Just start now and you will get better. It does seem it's all right for you, but that's a catchphrase I hear in business a lot and I hear it with self-employed people a lot. It's all right mm-hmm. for you. You get to do what you want. It's all right for you. You're doing a job you love. And your nearest and dearest will say this to you as well. It's all right for you. But what they never say is, it's all right for you. You work blooming hard. That's the bit they don't say.
No, and I get, it's interesting because I have this conversation with so many people in business where they go, oh, it must be so nice. You've got the freedom to do this, that and the other. And I go, you haven't seen the 80-hour week average. You don't see all the other stuff. But I'm going to go back to what you talked about there with stories, because I think stories is really important. And I have a favourite saying that I talk to my clients and I talk about in business and I talk to any of the licensees on my team. And it's a favourite saying that I always have. People won't always remember what you did. They won't always remember what you said, but they will always remember how you made them feel.
Absolutely.
And that is what comes from stories.
Yeah, it does. And I've made a decision. This might change in the future, but I'm a member of the PSA, the Professional Speakers Association. We get a couple of guest speakers every month, and they're always really good. And one of them, I hope he's not listening, but he was really good. And he was called the slides guy. He's the best guy in the country at making slides really exciting, and they pop and they ping and they move about and they're mm-hmm. animated and they're sexy and brilliant. And my eyes were on Stokes. He was great. He's going, you can do this, you can do that. And a couple of weeks later, I said to another person from the group, which slides can you remember? And he went, remember the one about the NHS? I said, I remember that one now you've mentioned it. I can only remember the one about Anne Boleyn. Now, this is the best slides guy in the country. Mm-hmm. And he's got the very best slides there are. And between us, we could only remember two of his slides. Mm-hmm. The greatest speakers you can think of tend not to use any slides. Mm-hmm. They just tell stories. Martin Luther King, you know, Tony Blair. Who, usually, I think great speakers don't need slides.
Yeah.
Just concentrate on you, your story, your message, and sell the sizzle. Believe in it. Just share passion. Mm-hmm. And I think if you've got stories that you've used the word authentic, true mm-hmm. to you, A, you'll remember them easier. Mm-hmm. But people will remember them easier and they'll sell your message more. Because if you use other people's stories when people go on stage, they say, Gandhi once said, or, you know, Mother Teresa once said, mm-hmm. that's someone else.
Yeah.
What have you got to say that people will remember? What is your footprint? And I think it's stronger if you do that.
It's interesting you say that, because I got asked to speak at the TEDx Teesside dinner last year. And I get up and talk about my journey, my childhood, and where I've come from to where I am now. And I don't use slides in those, because I won't talk about a subject that I'm not passionate about or I don't know. And I talked about my journey, and I had so many people come up to me afterwards and just went, thank you for sharing that. I couldn't stop crying.
Wow.
And that for me, and that led to then people within that room, bear in mind, these were all going to be TEDx speakers that year. And I felt really on edge getting up, because I've not done an official TEDx, but I was talking to them about my story. And these are people that were going to be on TEDx the next day, who said, you made me cry. I loved your story. Please apply to speak on TEDx next year.
Do it.
So guess what?
You're doing it.
Well, I've applied. They haven't gone through the process yet. I was the first person to apply. So I applied and I got a message coming back. So as soon as I saw it, I was like, right, I'm going to apply. And they came back and they said, do you know you were the first person to apply? And I was like, so we will see. But
Fingers crossed.
I would love to talk, because
it's
a real passionate subject that I've applied to talk about, which is about being a role model and helping just one person in the Northeast to know that whatever life throws at them, they can still achieve what they want to achieve with someone that helps them. That, for me, is what it's about.
Can I ask you, did you include in your talk, because I listened to your podcast episode with you as the guest, where you talked about defending yourself against a company. Do you talk about that?
I touch on that.
That leapt out to me.
Yeah.
As a visual, I think back to that episode. That to me was the standout bit for me, because it was visual. It was you talking about how nervous you were, how all these solicitors asked you questions, and then you were in the hot seat. And I just think I would love more of that. I know there's only so far you can go with that sort of story.
There is, and it is public record. I can talk about who it is, but I'm not going to at this time. But it's...
But I mean the drama and the incident that I would have listened to more of that story.
I nearly walked out of court on day two. And that experience has given me lessons in business. It was why I went into business on the back of it, to help other people to try and prevent that. But I can genuinely and authentically talk about, if I'm advising a client not to go down that route, I can talk about what it is from a claimant point of view as well as a respondent.
Yes.
So what's it like as a person? And it is a story that I talk about, and I can genuinely say, don't put yourself through it. I knew what I was doing. And actually, if we can get you to not reach that point, which is now why I mediate, and I'm a civil and workplace mediator as well, I can try and avoid you getting to that point, because it was brutal. I thought, I don't need anyone with me. I went on my own. And I wish I'd took my husband. I wish I'd took a moral support for myself. I fought my own corner, but I nearly walked out of court at lunchtime on day two of three, because I didn't think I could take any more. But you know what? I held my own and I thought, no, I'm going to do this. And then it was my turn to challenge them.
It's a real mouse that road story.
Yeah.
And you remember them. And everybody roots for, well, like you.
The underdog. I was the underdog. I was that little guy on that day.
Brilliant.
And I did. And I walked away and I won. And this is why I'm now in business, to inspire great HR and for people not to end up in that position. Speaking on stage or speaking publicly and having eyes on you is not easy. We all go through imposter syndrome. I feel that I am a typical extrovert. For anyone that knows me, I'm very high energy. I'm very high extrovert. But I'm very self-aware of my own personality as well. Do you think if you're an extrovert, you find it easier to speak publicly and be in business and get yourself known than if you were an introvert?
Well, the last time I did a Myers-Briggs test, I was an introvert.
Right.
And most people wouldn't believe that. My idea of, I wouldn't say hell, but awkwardness, would be on a big round table with about 10 people and one conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's usually a loud person orchestrating it and going, well, what do you think, Alfie? I think, I'm not sure because there's 10 people waiting for me in front of 300 people, 3,000 people. No problem. I still get nervous, but I think imposter syndrome, it fascinates me. First of all, I wouldn't call it a syndrome. Syndrome's a severe medical.
Yeah.
And I use a system to flip it for people and I say, don't call it a syndrome. Just call it healthy excitement, humble nerves, humble excitement. And you've flipped it into something that matters. You care. Just means you care.
Mm-hmm.
Preparation. If you've done your preparation, that's the best defense against nerves. If you over-prepare, it almost distracts you. It'll help distract you. The biggest times I've fallen down or fallen short or not been good is when I wasn't prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Not when I was nervous. It was when I wasn't prepared enough.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would say, there's a great speaker called Nadia Feiner who spoke at Thinking Digital for Herb Kim and she was just soup, knocked me out. She has a very timid voice and she's a very shy person. She wrote lots of books. One of them is called The Shy and Mighty. And she talks about shyness as being a diversity issue, which I never thought of. And I've thought of it a lot since. And I completely was won over by her talk and by her argument that shy people can talk and shy people should be heard. And I think I sometimes prefer people who come across as quite shy or humble or less bombastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes think shyer people make better interviewers. Or introverts can make better interviews because they're more interested and they listen better. And if you think of some of the great interviewers of the past, like Michael Parkinson or David Frost, they're not big, loud, showy people.
Mm-hmm.
They're people who are just deeply curious. They're just very, very interested. I think that's what you need more than anything to be a really good interviewer. You need to listen.
And that's really interesting because I know I'm an extrovert and I'm very open about active listening. I have to actively do it because in my brain, my busy brain, I'm always thinking about what next I'm going to say, but then that distracts you from genuinely listening to the person in front of you. And I agree. I think there's a misconception out there for anyone going into business that to get yourself out there, get yourself visible, get yourself speaking, you have to be extrovert, and actually you don't. And I know that my energy level can be too high for some people. It's too high for some of my clients. I've got an introvert within my team. When I know my energy level's too high for that client, that consultant, which is Mark, which is my brother, we're total opposites, he will look after that client because I'm too much of a whirlwind.
Yeah,
I do coaching. I have to calm my mind and my energy down before I go into coaching because I know it's too high for that environment. So you do, I think whether you're introvert or extrovert, it doesn't really matter, but I think it's important. In business, you've got to get yourself out there. Now, I want to talk about something that's very close to my heart with you, Alfie. You have got an absolute heart of gold, and I want to talk about something that you personally did for me just before Christmas that had a real impact for me. So people know I am ADHD myself. That's something I discovered in recent years, which is why I'm so passionate about it. And I'm very much an advocate of inclusivity. And, you know, I personally do neurodiversity screening now. It's a service we offer in the business. And we specialise in neurodiversity advice on reasonable adjustments and helping workplaces and individuals in the workplace thrive and for businesses to understand them. And my son, I discovered this on the back of one of my clients who are also a neurodiverse CIC. They actually noticed my son stimming at that point when it was pointed out to me. I didn't even know what it was. It was school holidays. He'd gone along to a meeting with me and he'd started suddenly having outbursts when he was on the iPad, which for me made me jump out my skin and would annoy me, and he'd get told off for it. But the actual client...
A verbal shout.
Or a sudden excitement, and it threw me. And I'd be like, Thomas, quiet, you've just made me jump. And he kind of went to doing back what he was doing. And the client looked at me and she went, you do know he's stimming, don't you? And I had no clue at that point what stimming was. And stimming is a kind of a reaction. It's a bit of an outburst. It's part of him handling and getting that excitement out with what he was doing at that point. Had no clue. I had to go away and research it. And that actually is what started my personal journey, because as I then looked into neurodiversity, whether that's ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyscalculia, many conditions, then I started noticing little, I was like, oh, that's me, that's me. Mm-hmm. Oh, that'll explain a lot from my childhood and school and all these little tick boxes. And I've obviously gone through some of the screening and I am ADHD and I've done that with my son. My son's autistic ADHD. Now, from a day-to-day life, he's very well managed. He's a little bit like me. He will interrupt. He is impatient. So they're two very strong traits in him. And from an autistic point of view, he has to have structure and he's a beige food eater. He doesn't do strong flavours. Yeah. Things can't touch. They can't be wet, things like that. So, but when it comes to trying to get him to sit and watch a film or a pantomime, in this case, within 10 minutes, I'm bored. Are we done? How much longer have we got? So I was expecting when I went to your pantomime, I'd already told him all about you. And I purposely booked the pantomime, which wasn't local to me. You know, I had closer ones, but I wanted to see you in panto. Yeah. Because I heard how brilliant you were and I knew it would be a great panto. So I booked the tickets and I made you aware I was coming along. And you were like, what's your son's name? And we went along, so he couldn't, as soon as you were on stage, I was to my son, there's Alfie. So he started waving at you and I know he kept waving. I know when you could, you gave a little indication or wave back, which for the first time ever, and pantomime for me, my daughter's 24 now, my son's 11. Pantomime has been an annual thing for me. I've always took the children. And for the first time ever, my son was excited. He watched it all the way through. I never got a, are we done yet? He waved at you every time you come on. But what really stood out for me was you had personally asked the dame to do a shout out for him. To this day, oh my God, the excitement. He still talks about it and he cannot wait to see you in pantomime again. Well, and that for me, actually, I was really tearful because for the first time, I'd seen him excited. He wanted to attend again. He was attentive. He loved it. And I am so grateful that you gave him that joy. And he now looks at panto in such a different way.
Well, I'll completely give the credit. That theatre is known as the little theatre with the big heart. And when I started on the radio, I used to go to all of the pantomimes because I had to review them for the afternoon show. So I'd go to everywhere from Berwick down to Borough, all the pantos. And I loved them all and I interviewed people who were in them. You'd interview some big name celebrities. They used to have American TV stars coming over for a certain time. Starsky and Hutch, people like that were in them. And so I loved pantomime. I loved them all. But that venue, that pantomime, was the one I kept taking my children to because there was something different about it and something special about it. And really, the dame, Ray Spencer, is a very special person. And he creates a lot of what you mentioned there. And it never goes too far with the body stuff. It never goes too far with adult, it never goes too far with silly. It just seems to hit all of the right things because mm-hmm. Ray is so experienced, but he's such a community person that it's all led from him. And he's a great friend, and I've just loved the last 3 years. I've learned everything that I know about pantomimes from him. Mm-hmm. And I share a dressing room with him. We have such a laugh. But we do, I try and find out who's in and try and get the dame to mention if there's someone I know in. And because it makes such a difference. The kids absolutely love it if they're singled out or mentioned. And mm-hmm. it is such a special thing. And Ray knows that this is something that is passed on because kids grow up. And then what happens is they start to get the jokes that the parents mm-hmm. get, and they stay, and then they eventually take their own children. It's just brilliant to see.
And you know, and I'm just very grateful. You made a big difference to a very special little boy that day, which I'm very, very grateful for. And I'm sure he'll be very excited tonight when I go home
Lovely.
And show him the picture and tell
there
him how
go.
We talked. And you're also a fabulous artist. You know, I've got a very special picture, which I purchased at a recent charity event you were hosting.
Yeah, the Cat and Dog Shelter. The
Newcastle Cat and Dog Shelter, where I was a guest of Ashley Wright, one of my clients at Westray. She's also a trustee of the charity, and I was a guest on the table with her. I remember seeing this one-off piece of art that you had put in the silent auction initially, and I spoke to you about it and went, oh my God, I've seen this piece of art. I'm absolutely bidding on it. That is going up in my office. And you were like, they had quite a lot, and you know, I've put it into the raffle. And I'm like, no. So I went and purposely found the staff from the shelter and went, I know it's getting put in the raffle, but actually, if I bought that off you, that would be more money into your charity pot that you weren't expecting. What if I, and it was never on the original raffle list, so how about I offer you a pot of money and I can have that drawing? And they took me up on it, and I purchased your drawing, which now has pride of place in my office.
Brilliant. I'm delighted. I loved that night, and they just sent me a message the other day saying they raised 3 times the amount to previous years, so they're over the moon. Brilliant.
Fantastic. Alfie, I have had such a fabulous podcast and discussion with
me
you.
Me as well.
I love talking to you, and I always love seeing you at events, and I can see you've got loads more coming up where I'll be attending, and it's always either yourself or Charlie, which I love. So I'm looking forward to that. Now, you are inspiring the next generation of speakers, but what's next for you?
I'll be honest, I still love comparing, still love hosting, still love interviewing, but what I'm really getting a buzz out of at the minute, and you saw me getting overexcited there earlier on, is keynote speaking. I'm loving talking about talking because I just think it's such an opportunity for businesses, for individuals, for companies, for charities to just do so much more. And I can't wait to tell as many people as I can about that. I'll turn up on any stage and chat about that.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I've had a fantastic conversation, and obviously key takeaways for people today listening, which a lot of them will be HR professionals, consultants starting or growing in business, is very much about the importance of being visible, getting out there, talking with confidence. It doesn't matter whether you're introvert or extrovert, get yourself out there and get talking. Don't worry if it doesn't go great.
No.
You only learn from it and work out what works best for you. So, for example, I'm not very good at wordy slides or scripting. I'm very much that person.
I'll
tell a story, and I'll get up on stage and I'll talk about something I know and love, and that's much easier for me. If people wanted to connect with you, Alfie, and learn from you, how can they connect with Alfie? Where do they need to go to?
LinkedIn's the best one for me. I'm there pretty much every day, and I respond on there very quickly. So Alfie Joey on LinkedIn and all the other platforms, from TikTok to Insta to Facebook. But I like LinkedIn. I think it's a very positive, less nasty world than some of the others.
Fantastic. And I'll certainly be going to look for some of your historical recordings to see what I can learn from you. And,
that was awful.
And
listen,
maybe not your earlier ones, your ones in your later career. Thank you for listening today. Don't forget to like, subscribe and share our podcast, and leave us a review if there is something you would like to share with us.